At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Today on the program, monetary policy that's got a beat to it, the often misunderstood role of foreign exchange in global trade, and you don't even want to know what Facebook knows about you from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Monday today, the 16th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. President Trump said today that he plans to make two nominations to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Picked to be vice chairman of the Fed.
Well, won't you wanna be my girl and make me make you mine?
Was economist Richard Clarida.
Say that I'm the one not wasting all your time.
He's a Harvard PhD.
Hey, you've been told, pretend that you don't care.
Once upon a time, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy. Currently a managing director at PIMCO, the big bond manager. And a professor of economics at Columbia University. Also, a country singer. This is Be My Girl from his 2015 album, Time No Changes.
Won't you wanna see me, girl, and make me make you mine? Well, won't you say that I'm the one not wasting all your time?
Pretty good, right? I mean, you know, it's catchy. In all seriousness, Clarida's a pretty mainstream Republican economist. And again, he is an economist and an expert in monetary policy, interest rates, of course, which is a plus when Chair Jay Powell is not an economist. Also nominated today was Michelle Bowman. She's been the Kansas State Bank Commissioner for about a year and a half. No clue as to her musical tastes. This brings, by the way, to six the number of seats filled or with nominees on the seven-member Fed Board of Governors. Foreign exchange might not have catchy lyrics, but currency trading is as important to this country's macroeconomic health as the Fed's monetary policy is, which gets us to a decision by the Treasury Department last week and a tweet from the president this morning. A couple of times a year, the Treasury Department looks at our biggest trading partners and decides whether any of them are manipulating their currencies, that is, artificially pushing the value of that currency down to help goose their exports. Nobody was hit with a manipulator label in the latest report from Treasury that was out on Friday, but decisions by his own government often don't dissuade the president from saying what he believes, as in this morning on his Twitter feed, quote, Russia and China are playing the currency devaluation game, he went on, not acceptable. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on presidential macroeconomic Twitter duty today.
Most large currencies float, which means the value of, say, the dollar against the euro could rise or fall, bobbing along, basically on the currents of supply and demand. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
If there is a lot of demand for a country's currency because people are buying up a lot of exports from that country or want to invest in that country, that tends to drive up the value of that currency.
A strong currency is good for buying things, but not selling them. Your exports are more expensive relative to foreigners. So a country that wants to boost its exports to help its domestic economy at the expense of others might try and cheapen its currency to intentionally mess around with supply and demand.
So if China wanted to prevent its currency from appreciating too fast, it would basically buy up dollars.
And it would sell its own currency. Thing is, China, not really doing this right now, despite President Trump's tweet. It definitely used to.
China was a major manipulator for many years between about 2003 and 2013.
Joe Gagneau with the Peterson Institute says then in 2015 and 16, instead of keeping its currency artificially low, China actually kept it high. That helped make U.S. exports more competitive. Nowadays, China, along with five other countries, is on a Treasury watch list that gets extra scrutiny. But generally, currency manipulation isn't a big problem.
It's not happening now because the global economy is doing well. Unemployment isn't a big problem in many places, so it's not needed.
Joe Gagnon says that could change in another recession if countries wanted to spur domestic hiring by selling more exports. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
While much of political journalism this week and parts of last, to be sure, have been all Comey all the time, it's worth an observation here that the doggone book isn't even out yet. Tomorrow is the official publication date, a pre-order bestseller, without a doubt. But allow us to inject a little supply and demand reality into this particular genre, the insider memoir. With the high turnover of senior staff at the White House and other government agencies, it's a pretty safe bet this isn't the last blockbuster political tell-all we'll be seeing on bookshelves during this administration. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on the slice of the publishing industry that might stand to benefit.
The political memoir sits in the category of adult nonfiction, and books like the one James Comey is releasing tomorrow have been doing so well lately, they're giving a boost to the whole genre.
Adult nonfiction and political books are a really hot segment of the market now.
Marissa Bluestone is with the Association of American Publishers. She says booksellers are seeing increased demand for intel on what's happening in Washington. In 2016, more than 600 million such books were sold.
We continue to see lots of activity around that and expect to see some really interesting books coming out in the coming years.
And probably even sooner. Bluestone says you always see a spike in sales for political nonfiction leading up to and after an election. But Brooke Warner says this administration is not like the others.
I think the primary difference is just you're seeing a lot of people being fired from the Trump administration who are then immediately getting book deals.
Warner spent years in the industry and co-founded her own independent publishing houses. She says the public nature of some of these firings make the stories of those exiting the White House ripe for a book deal.
There is a huge difference in the revolving door of the Trump administration and therefore maybe more disgruntled people who feel like they have a story to tell.
And publishers seem eager to help them tell it and sell it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Eager is one way to describe traders today as earnings season gets going for reals. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. During his congressional testimony last week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was asked by Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal whether he thinks Facebook users should be able to get their hands on all the information the company and advertisers have on them. Here's what Zuckerberg said.
Senator, we have already a download your information tool that allows people to see and to take out all of the information that Facebook, that they've put into Facebook or that Facebook knows about them.
The key phrases there were all of the information and take out. Brian Chun is the lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times. He tried to do both of those things, see and take out information on his own Facebook page using that very tool that Zuckerberg was talking about. Brian, it's good to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When you started off on this exercise of getting your data, what did you think you would find?
Honestly, I didn't really think I was going to find anything at all. I barely ever use Facebook. I don't really post much. My profile is pretty sparse. So when I opened my file, I expected there to be nothing interesting in there, and I was unpleasantly surprised.
Give me a list of what was most unpleasantly surprising then, say the top three.
Probably the list of advertisers with my contact information. There was a list of about 500 companies I had never heard of, including one called Bad Dad, which sounds kind of dirty, but turns out they're a motorcycle company. The second thing that kind of bothered me was there was a list of friends I've deleted, which just seemed kind of oxymoronic to me because I thought I deleted them. And I guess the third thing was probably just that there's a history of advertisements I had clicked on. There was no way to purge that information.
There is some stuff data-wise that you can delete, right? But then there's some stuff you can't. Once you figure out what they have, you can go through and do some deleting, but you can't delete everything.
You can't delete everything, and if you can delete things, it's not very easy to figure out how to do that. It's simple enough to download your information, but once you see all the information, it's not like it's this user-friendly tool where you have like the X button for every single piece of data in there. You can't start just clearing things out. It's all kind of buried in there, so it's not simple at all.
The note I wrote to myself as I was reading your piece was Facebook never forgets. You can delete your account, and there's still going to be stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they say they delete your data off their servers after 90 days if you delete your account. But third-party applications, like in the case of Cambridge Analytica, they've already been collecting your information for many, many years. So once you delete Facebook, you've already lost the game.
Give me a sense of scale. How big was this data file that you got from Facebook?
The data file on Facebook was about 650 megabytes. That's the equivalent of about maybe 120 hours of digital music. It was nowhere near as big as Google. My Google file was about 8 gigabytes large, wow. So exponentially larger than the Facebook one. Facebook is really just the tip of the iceberg.
I was just going to say, do you think we're missing the forest for the trees here? And the greater order of magnitude of information that Google has on us than Facebook does?
I think there's an argument that can be made that there's probably a bigger story in Google, but they haven't been discovered to have been doing anything improperly or have been breached by a third party like Facebook has. So right now, understandably, Facebook is in the news. But I do think in the coming weeks and months, we're probably going to be taking a closer look at how exactly and why Google collects some information.
I was brought up short by the last line in your piece as I started thinking about maybe going to look for my own data. And you said, once you see the vast amount of data that has been collected about you, you won't be able to unsee it. I wonder if a lot of people are like, la, 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 fingers in my ears. I just don't want to know what they know about me.
Yeah, you know, I actually didn't really want to go through this exercise because I was assigned it, you know. And again, I thought it was going to be a pretty boring exercise. But once I saw all that stuff, it's kind of like, you know, Neo in the Matrix, once he gets shot and he reawakens, like he has a rebirth moment, right? And he sees all the green lines of code everywhere. That's kind of like how I feel about having seen my Facebook data. I can't unsee it anymore.
Wow. Brian Chun is the lead consumer technology writer at the New York Times. Brian, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kai.
Despite the president's tweet this morning about China devaluing its currency, which it is not, for the record, because facts matter, we seem, emphasis on the word seem here, to be at a calm moment in the will-they-or-won't-they U.S.-Chinese trade war back and forth. American companies doing business in China do complain they don't have a level playing field with their Chinese competitors, and for some American businesses over there, things could get worse because of a policy called Made in China 2025, which is all about China making itself a technology leader in a bunch of economic sectors, manufacturing and green energy among them. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak explains from Shanghai.
The first thing you need to know about policies in China is that they can be incredibly effective if the government wants them to be, like when the public got angry about the smog in northeastern China back in 2013. The next year, the government declared a war on pollution.
In 4 years, air pollution concentrations declined by 32% on average.
Michael Greenstone runs the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. He says China's air is still polluted by international standards. But if the current pollution cuts are sustained, everyone in China could expect to live almost 2.5 years longer, which he says is remarkable.
By comparison, it took the United States about 12 years after the enactment of the Clean Air Act to achieve a similar reduction.
China's Communist Party cut air pollution by doing something that couldn't be easily done in the U.S. It shut down coal mines and cut production of iron and steel.
Local officials, I think, used any and all techniques to get there, including removing coal boilers, even in places where there was not yet natural gas lines.
So foreign companies were worried when 3 years ago, officials unveiled an even more ambitious policy called Made in China 2025. Max Zenglin with the Mercator Institute for China Studies in Germany explains.
Made in China 2025 is an underlying industrial policy to become a technology leader in 10 specific industries.
That includes upgrading China's robotics, aviation, and green energy. China is lagging in some of these sectors, so there would still be room for foreign companies, but most likely in some kind of restrictive joint venture deal. Long term, the policy is about self-sufficiency, says Zenglin.
China wants to become less reliant on foreign technology and therefore also foreign companies within the Chinese market.
U.S. and European business groups complain that this will make doing business in China even harder. But a researcher with China's State Council, Zhao Chengwen, told state-run CCTV that there is nothing to fear. Made in China 2025 will keep its markets open, he says. China will treat all enterprises equally, without discrimination. Mariusz Trzaskowski with the analysis group Solidians thinks otherwise. He says, for example, in recent years, foreign firms have tried to make batteries for electric cars in China.
However, they actually didn't get the license to build the large batteries. So this is all basically dominated by local suppliers.
What's more, he says, companies in China have been securing metals needed to make electric car batteries, and that could really tilt the electric vehicle game in favor of China. But foreign auto companies still have a chance, says Bill Russo, an ex-Chrysler executive in China who now runs the consultancy firm Automobility in Shanghai. He says American firms may complain about restrictive policies in China, but they've also made good money in the country over the last 14 years.
One American company exists today that may not have existed had it not been for China, and that's General Motors.
And he warns no matter how many tariffs the U.S. imposes, it won't help American firms compete with Chinese companies in the industries of the future. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you look nationally, students are accepted at a higher rate in early decision.
Yes, a higher rate, but it does come with some costs. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 212 today, 0.8%, 24,573. The NASDAQ up 49 points, about 0.7%, 71.56. S&P 500 gained 21 points, 0.8%, 26.77. Bank of America grew 0.4% today on better-than-expected first-quarter profits and revenue. Domino's Pizza rose 0.8% as the company announced it would start making deliveries to outdoor locations like beaches and parks, which would be handy, I suppose. The world's biggest advertising agency, WPP, fell 4.6% today. The firm's founder and CEO, Martin Sorrell, has stepped down amid a misconduct investigation. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect your lives so you can make better decisions. Well, here's your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across this country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can grow and keep getting better. Become a Marketplace investor today. Whatever amount is right for you, it goes twice as far right now. Give online at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two music items to pick things up with today. First of all, after 75 years of jazz and classical winners, this year the Pulitzer Prize Committee decided, the heck with it, let's pick Kendrick. Huh? Rapper Kendrick Lamar won for his album Damn. The Pulitzer Board said the album captures, quote, the complexity of modern African-American life, end of quote. Item two, and related, did you hear about Beyoncé at Coachella on Saturday? A two-hour set at the highest-grossing musical festival in the country, but really so much more. Danielle Young is a writer and producer at TheRoot.com. We got her on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
She didn't have to do this, right? I mean, it's not like she needs the gig. Why? Give me your best sense. Why did she do Coachella this year?
Listen, Beyonce never needs a gig, but she's an artist. So Beyonce could not work for the rest of her life and still maintain her lifestyle and be fine. But I think that like any artist, you know, you need that outlet. Beyonce opened up a whole can of blackness to the world. And I love that she was able to do that. So I think with this performance, what Beyonce was trying to do was using her artistry to be a voice for the voiceless. And for right now, that voiceless population is Black America.
That's a great line, a whole can of blackness. I imagine you were, as you were sitting there watching the live stream, first of all, they have a live stream of Coachella, right? So you didn't actually have to haul out into the desert.
I did not have to go to the desert, thank goodness.
Well, you know, I mean, Coachella's a nice place, gets a little warm. But look, as you were watching this live stream.
Coachella's great.
Yeah, as you were watching this live stream, what was, I imagine you were texting with your friends and IMing and all that stuff. What was the conversation you were having with your friends like?
So, I mean, first of all, it was a preparation. Beyonce put out a statement on her social media, basically letting us know what time she would be on in every time zone that there has ever been. And so being here on the East Coast, I knew that my time was 2:05 a.m. Immediately, I was a little bit sad because I'm in my 30s, and that is the time where I'm either rolling over or trying to figure out why I'm not asleep yet. So it was one of those moments that I hit up my friends, and I was like, okay, we have to plan. Because yeah. it's not enough to just be like, okay, 2:05. No, I needed to be up by 1:45 I can shake myself awake. Yep. I can fix myself a cocktail and sit myself in front of the TV to make sure that I am ready to experience every drip drop. Like, I didn't want to miss anything.
So what do you think? Yeah, no, I hear you. What do you think happens next year, though, right? What's the follow-on? I mean, Beyonce is going to be there next weekend, but Coachella a year from now, then what?
Man, I don't know. It's like she constantly raises the bar. That, like, gone are the days where artists put out these albums and people are lined up at the record store waiting, you know, to get their hands on a copy. So Beyonce brings back the nostalgia of waiting for music to be released, waiting to consume albums together. So I think she does that with everything that she releases. And this is going to be another episode of what can't Beyonce do? Yeah. Because this kind of performance is not typically seen at Coachella, where it's like a full-on spectacle. And hopefully, you know, the artists that sign on for next year realize that there's a big pair of beautiful silvery boots that need to be filled. And Beyonce has left those there for the next artist to really, you know, dig deep within their talents and show that being a performer at Coachella is more than just letting your hair blow in the breeze. It's like a full-on show.
Danielle Young, she's a writer and producer at TheRoot.com, talking about Beyonce last night at Coachella. Danielle, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking about my queen.
There you go. Awesome. Thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you soon. We're just past the point of maximum pressure for a lot of high school seniors in this country, where they're going to wind up going to college if that's the way they choose to go. College admissions are a roll of the dice, right? But one particular slice of who gets in where is getting some attention from the Justice Department. Several elite schools say they've been asked to preserve any documents or information about early decision when students apply early to a particular school and then promise to take themselves out of the running at other places if they get in. College officials say the Justice Department seems to be looking into possible antitrust violations, but that is not the only complaint that people have with early decision. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
A fun thing to do when you have a few minutes is watch college acceptance videos on YouTube.
Oh no, oh no. Oh.
This is Riley Hickman, a high school senior in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's December, the living room is decked out for Christmas, and she's sitting at her laptop, flanked by mom and dad, awaiting a message from Cornell University.
No, I don't want to.
Okay.
I don't want to.
Okay.
That goes on for a while. Remember I said it was December? Usually college decisions don't come until March. But Hickman applied for early decision at Cornell. If she got in, she promised to withdraw her applications from other colleges.
It was definitely my favorite school and my first choice, so I thought that early decision would be the right decision.
And it's an increasingly popular decision for both students and colleges. Robert Massa is Senior Vice President for Enrollment at Drew University in New Jersey and former Dean of Admissions at Johns Hopkins. With the rise of the Common Application and intense anxiety about getting in, he says students apply to far more colleges than they used to.
And so that makes it very, very difficult for the colleges to predict their enrollments, right? Because if they're applying to seven or eight colleges, the chances of enrolling in any one are much smaller.
Early decision gives colleges some certainty about the incoming class. The vast majority of admitted students end up enrolling. In exchange, Massa says, early applicants have an edge.
I mean, if you look nationally, students are accepted at a higher rate in early decision.
Massa says some schools share lists of those students with other colleges to make sure the students really withdraw their applications. The Justice Department wouldn't comment on its investigation, but Amherst College, Grinnell, Pomona, Williams all confirmed receiving a letter from the department. It implies Justice is looking into whether those communications violate antitrust laws. That's not Seppi Basili's concern about early decision.
Early admission programs do disadvantage students from lower-income backgrounds.
Basili is COO of the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. It provides scholarships to high-achieving students from low-income families.
29% of students whose families made more than $250,000 a year used early decision as part of their process, and only 16% of students whose families made less than $50,000 did it. So right there, you see a huge disparity.
Basili says low-income students are more likely to have parents who didn't go to college themselves and can't guide them through the process. They may need to compare financial aid offers from several schools.
They may not have visited as many colleges. They may not have had their SAT and ACT scores done in time. Like, there's just a number of steps that you have to go through to be successful in the process that's harder and harder to do if you're not prepared for it.
Drew University's Robert Massa says colleges do work with students to make the financial aid add up and will let them out of the deal if they can't afford it. And he agrees colleges can do better outreach to give more students from all backgrounds a shot at this moment. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I offer in defense of a dietary mainstay at my house, a study in the journal BMJ Open says that pasta, as part of a healthy and balanced diet, is not necessarily to blame if you gain weight. The key quote from one of the researchers goes like this: "We're seeing a lot of anti-carbohydrate sentiment and a real attack on carbohydrates, in particular a lot of the staples like rice and bread and pasta." End of quote, and amen. So, you know, everything in moderation, people, all right? All right, we're going. Dow Industrials up 0.8% today. NASDAQ up 0.7%. S&P 500 up 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects team includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.